I actually got a barcode. That's terrific. So next time, I guess I'll give you a price tag. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is the experimental ways of proving for quantum gravity. And here is the outline of my talk. I'll just briefly touch on hierarchy problem. I guess for this audience, I don't really need to talk much about this, but I'll give you sort of empirical perspective on the hierarchy problem. And then we'll talk about various models with extra dimensions, because that's the stage I would like to set for the talk, and various experimental ways of proving these models, such as measurement of gravity at short distances, the astrophysical and cosmological constraints, and the ultimate way of looking for this type of signatures, which is collider experiments, which would allow us to either find extra dimensions or severely restrict their applicability to the standard model, at the very least. And I would finish with the few words on production of black holes at the Future Collider. That would be the ultimate probe of quantum gravity, of course. And there's two more talks by Marco Cavalli and Steve Giddings, who would tell you more about that. I guess one talk is this afternoon and the other one is tomorrow. Okay, so let me start with the hierarchy problem. And just remind you a very empirical fact that large hierarchies tend to collapse. That's a pure empirical observation which we can make in mechanical system, in political system, in social system, all around the world. And just looking at this picture, you know that if there's no strings attached, if there's nothing to protect this hierarchy, no extra layers of support, this thing is destined to collapse. It's, on the other hand, from the point of view of pure mechanics, there is no reason for this hierarchy to collapse. I clearly could build a mechanical system which would be very tall and very stable. The only problem is that if I want to, say, balance the pen on its tip on the surface of a table, I'll have to adjust my initial parameters, the motion of air in this room, the way I release the pen, to such a precision that it becomes empirically impossible. And that's essentially what the empirical problem with the standard model is, the hierarchy between the electronic symmetry breaking scale and the either God scale or the Planck scale. So that's another example of large hierarchy which has collapsed. It doesn't have to be mechanical. Yeah, there was no particular reason, but it did. And when I talked to Chris Krieg about that, he actually mentioned to me that there is a restaurant in San Francisco which is called B44, which is a very nice Catalonian restaurant. And in Catalonia is actually still very popular to build these pyramids. They call them human castles out of people. And the guy who is the owner of this restaurant, he actually uses the engineers from Bay Area, there's a lot of them who are his customers, to come up with the most well-engineered human tower, human castle, which doesn't collapse as long as possible. That's the whole idea of this competition. And actually, if you go to this restaurant, there's little movies of how it's going. And this is the one which I apologize for low quality of this movie. But you just look at this thing and you see how unstable it is. And you know it won't last long. And I guess the operator also knows it doesn't last long because you zoom on this human castle in a second. And you'll see what is going to happen. It becomes really unstable and then it collapses. And it's tough to be at the bottom. Every hierarchy which collapses. Okay. On the other hand, this, as I said, there's no physics or mechanical or mathematical principle why hierarchy should not exist. And in fact, there are some hierarchies which are surprisingly stable. Also, you should remember that certain examples of fine-tuning, which is what is needed to protect the large hierarchy, exist in nature. Probably one of the most abused example is the solar eclipse. It turns out that the angular sun of the, angular size of the sun, as observed from Earth, is the same as the angular size of the moon, again observed from the Earth, within 2.5%, which is a pure coincidence. There's no physical principle why the distances and the radii of these three bodies, celestial bodies, are in such a relationship. Nevertheless, we really owe to this coincidence such a beautiful image as solar eclipse. A little bit less abused example of fine-tuning to even higher degree is the infamous Florida recount in 2000 in the presidential election. where the ratio of Republican to Democratic vote was fine-tuned to unity with the precision of 10 to the minus 4. That's quite an amazing fine-tuning. Again, there is no physics principle I know of, but it's really happening. Even more interesting example comes from numerology. It turns out that if you punch in your calculator 9876543321 and divide it by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, the answer which you will get is fine-tuned to 8 with the precision of 10 to the minus 7. Again, there is absolutely no reason you would think that happens. Now, in this particular example, it's not really numerology, but it's very well hidden. And often, the fine-tuning which you see, which looks amazing to you, might actually be explained by some deep principle, in this case, it's mathematics of the base 10 system. If, in fact, you do this in hexadecimal calculator, you will get even more precise answer. It turns out that in the limit of infinite n, where n is the base of your numeric system, the answer is n minus 2 with the precision 10 to the minus n. That's why you see such high precision. But it's quite well hidden. When you first see it, somebody on the plane showed me this. I was quite amazed. I knew there must be an answer, but it took me a while to get it right. Of course, there is an alternative to this whole idea of fine-tuning, which is the anthropic principle, which tells us that properties of the universe are so special because our prior is very different from uniform prior, because the whole fact of our existence in this universe makes it extremely special. And the very fact that we are around to ask these questions might change the prior quite dramatically. But this won't be covered in this talk. That's probably a subject of several talks or even books, as we know. But I would stick to the non-anthropic reductionist approach in this talk. So let me now set the stage for three types of models I mainly will be talking about, which have very different analogies. So, and these are not really models. I would rather call them paradigms, but these are certain theoretical constructs I want to deal with for the purpose of this talk. The first one is the earliest one which appeared on the market, the 1998 idea of Arkady Hematimopoulos and Vlahov of large extra dimensions, where essentially we solve the hierarchy problem by postulating that there is no other scale beyond something of the order of 1 TeV, which is interesting at all. And in fact, Planck scale is about 1 TeV, and the only reason we think it's not 1 TeV is because we actually take the G Newton, Newton constant measured at very low energy, and we just extrapolate it incorrectly. Basically, in order to make this happen, in order to make gravity much stronger than it appears to a four-dimensional observer, they have to introduce the extra spatial dimensions, which are quite large, large even on macroscopic case, on macroscopic scale. They could be as large as about 1 millimeter, or maybe 1 centimeter. These are much larger than traditional extra dimensions in string theory construct, which are on the order of gut scale or Planck scale. All the standard model particles are confined to the 3 plus 1 dimensional world, the 3D brain. And gravity is the only force that permeates the so-called bulk space, the space of n extra dimension. The standard observation that Newton's law is going to be modified in multidimensional space can actually be circumvented by making the extra dimensions compact. If you think about this picture as the picture of this one-dimensional world, where one dimension is infinite and flat, and the other dimension, this circle, is compactified with a certain radius r, let's think about this as a charge which is sitting in the conducting cylinder. So if you look at the field lines of electromagnetic field, which is basically the same as gravitational field, if you think about this as the mass in such a universe, it's easy to see that the gravitational or electromagnetic gravitational flux has to become parallel to the boundaries of this surface as long as you're far away from the test charge or test mass, where being far away means being far away compared to the only parameter in this problem, which is the radius of the extra dimension. And therefore, if you're far away from the charge, you don't really see the second dimension. You see flux, which looks pretty much one-dimensional to you, except that the coefficient in front is changed. It's now suppressed by this extra volume of the extra dimension. And that's basically what is written here. The gravitational potential still is 1 over rho for rho much greater than the radius r of the extra dimension. And what's being modified here is that instead of the 3 plus n dimensional Planck scale to the n plus second power, you also get the suppression of r to the n, which essentially is the volume of extra dimensional space. And therefore, this new multidimensional Planck scale, which I'll call MD, is related to the apparent Planck scale, which is 1 over square root of g Newton, via this formula. And since r to the n could be large, the suppression is large, and therefore MD could be much smaller than M Planck. If you plug in the numbers and say that you want MD to be of the order of 1 TeV, it's easy to see that for one extra dimension, you need the radius to be very large, of the order of the size of the solar system. Now, this clearly has been excluded by the very existence of the solar system, since it won't be stable in 1 over r squared or r cubed potential. So this case has been excluded. But if you just allow for two extra dimensions, the radius drops dramatically to something of the order of 1 millimeter, and for higher number of extra dimensions, it reaches something like 1 Fermi, which is the nuclear size. Amazing as it is, but as of 1998, no one has really tested Newton's law to the distances less than about 1 millimeter, and therefore this whole loophole was completely open back then. And in fact, the fundamental Planck scale could be as low as 1 TeV for any n greater than 1, and we lived with this situation perhaps for many years without even noticing that this is the case. Another idea which appeared in 1998 was the so-called inverse TeV extra dimensions. These extra dimensions have typical size, which is characteristic of the electroweak symmetry breaking scale. We know that something is happening around 1 TeV, so 1 TeV is a natural scale, so why not have extra dimensions with the size of the order of 1 inverse TeV? The reason these people, Dinis Dudas and Gergetev, suggested this model back in 98 is to actually solve a different problem, different hierarchy problem, the hierarchy between the gauge forces and the gut scale of the order of 10 to the 16th GeV and the electroweak symmetry breaking scale of 1 TeV. So what they noticed is that the famous log linear behavior of the couplings for the gauge forces is only correct when you solve renormalization group equations in 3 plus 1 dimensions. However, if you add compact dimensions to the system and allow gauge bosons to propagate in these extra dimensions, every time you cross the next winding mode for these gauge bosons, which is of the order of 1 over r, of the order of TeV, you would get a different copy of this of the gauge bosons, the Kaluza-Klein excitations of the gauge bosons, to help you to carry the forces. And therefore, the coupling running changes quite dramatically, and instead of logarithmic, it could become a power law. And they show that without much fine-tuning, they could easily make three couplings to meet, say, at the energies of the order of 100 TeV, which is not a large hierarchy anymore with the electroweak scale. So the natural compactification scale for this type of extra dimensions is of the order of 10 to the minus 19 meters, or 1 inverse TeV. Finally, 1 year later, yet another model has appeared. That's a Randall-Sundrum model. And in its simplest reincarnation, essentially, if you just take the 3 plus 1 dimensional brain and embed it in the 5 dimensional anti-de Sitter space, with the warping being along the fifth coordinate orthogonal to this brain, it turns out that the wave function of the graviton, which originates on this brain, would fall off exponentially due to the warp factor if you go away from this brain in the fifth dimension. That's a cute observation, but it doesn't really help you if you live on this brain, because there is no way for you to probe what's happening with the graviton wave function away from the brain if you are stuck to this brain. However, if we add yet another brain to this model, which we'll call standard model brain, and put ourselves and all other interactions on this brain, then you could naturally see why the gravitational attraction, gravitational force is so big at the standard model brain. This is just due to the exponential fall off of the wave function. Graviton doesn't really overlap much with our brain, and therefore the operators with the size of M Planck on the Planck brain could naturally lead to the operators of the characteristic size of 1 TeV or so on the standard model brain, thus solving the hierarchy problem. So this is the picture of anti-de Sitter space by Escher. Essentially, it's a space of constant negative curvature. When you go, each slice of this space is Euclidean space, but when you go outside the radius, the metric changes and the interval shrinks because of this exponential suppression along the fifth dimension, which I call phi. So to make things a little bit more stable, you in fact want to stabilize these two brains on the orbifolds, on the Z2S1 orbifold, so you identify upper and bottom part of this circle, but basically the picture is very similar to the picture I showed you, and now you're free to pick any radius of compactification. You can make it infinite, or you could make it very small. Since you really want to deal only with one parameter in order to solve the hierarchy problem, and in this case, this one parameter is the Planck scale, that's the scale of gravity on the Planck scale, it would be natural to have the R of the order of inverse Planck scale, and then you can find out what kind of curvature, warp factor K, you need in order to naturally create the operators of the order of 1 TeV on the standard model brain from this following function of the graviton. And it's easy to see that for the product of Kr of the order of 10, which is a small amount of fine-tuning, the exponent of e to the minus 20 would give you enough suppression to essentially drop down the Planck scale to something of the order of 1 TeV. So that offers you a nice natural solution of the hierarchy problem. So that's the stage I'm going to sort of work with, these three broad classes of models. And of course, each of these classes has received a lot of different generalization. For example, in the Randall-Sandrum model, people started to peeling all the fermions from the brain, and fermions are allowed to propagate in the bulk. And this all results in some different phenomenology, and I'll touch on this in this talk. So now let me make a brief recap and just talk about these three models and compare them. The ADD paradigm, the reason I call it a paradigm is that it's not really a self-sufficient model, because you're trading one hierarchy, which is hierarchy of large scales in energy, for a totally different hierarchy, which is hierarchy of sizes. After all, there is nothing natural in particle physics, or we think there is nothing natural, about the size of about 1 micron or 1 millimeter, so you somehow have to explain what makes these extra dimensions so large, why they're 1 millimeter and not infinite or not very small. Nevertheless, people actually within this paradigm build some more realistic models where certain stabilization occurs, typically by introducing similar exponential factors as in Randall-Sandrum model. So the pro, of course, is that this type of paradigm eliminates the hierarchy problem whatsoever. Physics ends at 1 TeV, so we are almost there. We soon would know what is going to happen at the highest energy scale. Only gravity lives in the bulk space. Size of the extra dimensions for its their number between 2 and 7 is anywhere between of the order of 100 micron and 1 for me, and as I'll show you at the end, the black holes at the LHC and in the ultra-high energy cosmic rays would be copiously produced in this model. Of course, the con is that it doesn't really explain why extra dimensions are so large. Inverse TeV scenario doesn't really attack the problem of weak gravity. It only tries to lower the cut scale by changing the running of the coupling. And in this case, only gauge bosons, meaning photons, electric bosons, and gluons, propagate in the extra dimensions. And size of the extra dimensions is of the order of electric breaking scale, inverse TeV. Gravity is not part of this picture. Finally, the Randall-Sandrum model offers a more rigorous solution to the hierarchy problem via localization of gravity. Gravitons and possibly other particles propagate in the single extra dimension with a very special metric. As it turns out, black holes at the LHC and in ultra-high energy cosmic rays could also be produced in these models. And the cons of this model is that, first of all, These models are actually equivalent in some sense to generic compositeness models, which are not very favored by latest precision electric fits. The other thing is that it requires a big leap in faith, since we never dealt with the anti-de Sitter space before in any model which has been experimentally confirmed. So you really have to assume that this space has anything to do with nature around us. So now, from this picture, I can draw complete terminology of these three models, and that would lead me in the way to look for these models experimentally. So it all depends on the Kaluza-Klein spectrum of the particles which live in the bulk space. And Kaluza-Klein tower is basically another way of looking at the multidimensional particle. If you want to stay a 3+1 dimensional observer, you don't see the momentum of the particle in the direction orthogonal to your 3+1 dimensional world. So when you write the equation m squared equals to e squared minus p squared, this missing momentum looks like a mass to you. So instead of a momentum, you get the mass of, instead of missing momentum, the particle appears massive to you. Since any of these models quantum mechanically are equivalent to a particle in some kind of a box, whether the box is the size of x dimension or this warp metric, doesn't matter that much, only certain solutions in terms of the momentum projection on the bulk space are allowed from the boundary conditions, and that reflects itself in only certain values of mass allowed for this Kaluza-Klein tower. So the three-dimensional picture of a massless graviton in 3+n dimension is a Kaluza-Klein tower with the lowest expectation, lowest excitation being massless, and all subsequent excitations being spaced according to the particular boundary conditions. Now, the energy spacing is, of course, of the order of 1 over r, 1 over the size of extra dimensions. So in the ATD paradigm, this spacing is extremely small. It ranges between millielectron volt and something like 100 megaelectron volt for different number of extra dimensions. Experimentally, there is no way for us to distinguish between these subsequent modes of graviton. Therefore, the Kaluza-Klein spectrum looks continuous to us. And it has to be regulated by cutting it off at some value, a natural value for the cutoff is of the order of 1 TeV. That's where we postulate all the fundamental physics stops. And we don't really know what regulates this, but this has to be something of the order of 1 TeV. Now, coupling of each Kaluza-Klein mode is still given by G Newton, the standard small value of Newtonian coupling, but just because the number of couplings, number of Kaluza-Klein modes is so high and increases dramatically when you increase the energy at which you measure gravity, essentially these multiple Kaluza-Klein modes which we can access dictate the phenomenology and dictate the fact that gravity appears strong when you measure it at large energy. In the reverse TeV scenario, the spacing between adjacent modes of the Kaluza-Klein modes of the gauge bosons is again given by 1 over r, more precisely, it's quadratic. Since the mass of all the gauge bosons we are talking about is between 0 and 90 GeV, this is much smaller than 1 over r, which is of the order of 1 TeV, so effectively all the gauge boson excitations are pretty much degenerate, and they're basically equally spaced with the distance of the order of 1 over r of the order of 1 TeV, and this tower should probably be cut off at something of the order of mGut, where mGut is this new gut scale which you get from the low energy unification. Finally, in the RS model, we have a particle in a box which has a special ATS metric. So when you calculate the eigenvalues of the energy allowed in this problem, you get zeros of the Bessel function. And these zeros are actually spaced not equally, and they become more dense as you go higher in energy. The massless mode, the lowest mode of graviton remains massless, and it's coupled with the G Newton to other models, whereas all the excited modes of graviton are coupled with 1 over lambda pi squared, electroweak type of strengths, to the standard model fields. And if you call the mass of the first mode M1, then the second mode is 1.83, 266, 348, 4.0, and so forth. You see that the spacing between adjacent modes decreases. The higher you go in energy, the more dense this Kaluza-Klein tower becomes. And in this picture, this tower is really goes all the way to the Planck scale, because that's the only scale in this problem. So looking at these three different type of Kaluza-Klein tower, that all what I need in order to actually think about experimental consequences and terminology of how to move for various types of models, various paradigms, is extra dimensions. These type of models wouldn't give me any resonances. It would give me overall excess, which would increase at high energy. In this model and this model, I would like to see copies of either known gauge bosons or copies of graviton and perhaps other particles living in the bulk. So let me first start with the measurement of gravity at short distances. After all, the large extra dimensions could be immediately probed by looking at the change in the Newton's law when you approach the size between the attractors, distance between the attractors, similar to the size of extra dimensions. And since 1998, there was a lot of effort in improving the experiments which measure gravity at very short distances. Unfortunately, it's very hard to measure Newton's law precisely when the distances become of the order of 1 millimeter, because first of all, your bodies would become very small if you want to move them as close to each other as a fraction of a millimeter. Second of all, you start feeling a lot of background from electrostatics, which is much stronger than gravity, so you have to shield somehow from any residual charge from your attractors. And at some point, when you start approaching very close, the two body approach each other very close, you start feeling Casimir force, which you cannot shield from. So it's really a tour de force type of experiments. And this plot basically shows you the sensitivity of this experiment as a function of distance between the two attractors in meters. And what is called alpha on the vertical scale of this plot is essentially the precision of this experiment expressed in the units of normal Newtonian attraction. So 10 to the 0, 1, means that you could measure gravitational attraction to the error of 100% effectively. So you could say that the gravity is somewhere between 0 and twice what Newton predicted, but you cannot go any more precise than that. It turns out that in the case of compact dimensions, in the ATD case, alpha is equal to either 2 or 3, depending on whether you compactify on a torus or on a sphere. It's of the order of 1. And you see that the precision of this experiment really drops exponentially as you go closer in space between two attractors for the reasons I told you about. For example, if you go to 1 micron distance between the attracting bodies, you really cannot measure gravity with any decent precision. You could make an error of the order of 10 to the 12th because it's really very hard experiment and there's a lot of background. However, the place where these compact dimensions intersect with the best measurement so far, which comes from the University of Washington group by Edelberger et al., is of the order of 160 or so microns. And essentially, they ruled out any radius of compactification greater than about 160 microns, which corresponds to the Planck scale of the order of 1.7 TeV. Now, that's right in the range we want it to be, but clearly, this is not enough to exclude, say, Planck scale 5 TeV, which would be perfectly natural from the point of view of hierarchy problem. Just to give you an example of how these experiments are done, Edelberger's experiment is, in fact, a high-tech remake of the famous Cavendish experiment. It's just done in a very similar fashion. You have a torsion balance, and you essentially move attractors close to the torsion balance, and you see how the torsion balance starts wiggling, and by shining a light, in his case a laser or a little reflector attached to this torsion balance, one could see the deviation by projecting it on the screen. Now, that's a very sort of simple-minded way of telling you how this experiment worked, but just to give you an idea of precision, this experiment has been done in Washington State. So it turns out that if you project the laser from this torsion balance from Washington State all the way to San Francisco and let it shine on the pyramid, famous pyramid in the downtown of San Francisco, the change in angular response of this balance Edelberg is capable of measuring would correspond to about 1 inch deviation of the laser beam on the pyramid. So it is a tour de force experiment. And it's clear that while we start curving the case of 2x two dimensions, we are completely clueless to ask what would happen with 3x two dimensions, where the size of the x two dimensions of the order of atomic size, 10 to the minus 9 meters. Even with nanotechnology, it's very hard to imagine that we could measure gravitational attraction between two atoms at the distance of the order of the size of lattice, crystal lattice in typical material. So the projected sensitivity of these studies is shown here. They're all improving their experiments, and the new players come in the game. But you see that we really won't be able to move much in terms of the distance to which we probe Newtonian law, maybe by another factor of two by the end of this decade, which would probably be enough to significantly curb the case of two extra dimensions or maybe find some evidence for modification of the Newton's law. These type of experiments really don't have sensitivity to either inverse TV or random sampling models. The only way they could probe it is because they're sensitive to moduli fields in some models, which might be common for string theory-like constructs. There are new ideas in gravity measurement which have to do with atomic physics. For example, the group at Stanford is working on the special interferometer experiment, where essentially people look at the change of the atomic resonances when you move the attractor to the atomic resonator, very high Q resonator. And this experiment might be sensitive to things like axions, but if you compare them on a similar plot with what has been achieved so far, the really improvement around alpha of 1, which is log alpha of 0, is not very great. It's, again, of the order of factor of a few. Okay, so now let's move to astrophysics and cosmology. After all, large energies at which these phenomena should become apparent happened in the very early universe, and the only problem is how to disentangle these effects imprinted on early universe through the inflation and all the evolution the universe has undergone in 10 to the 10 years since the Big Bang. And a few ways how people were able to curb these models are, first of all, the supernova cooling. If gravitational interaction becomes strong, the alternative mechanism of supernova cooling is now allowed. Instead of throwing off energy in neutrinos, you could throw it off using gravitons and throw it off in all the dimensions. And that would decrease the neutrino emission from the supernova. And the fact that we were able to detect a handful of neutrinos which were correlated with supernova 1987A back 20 years ago actually allowed these people to translate these non-zero flux, which has been observed, into limits on the size of the extra dimensions or the fundamental Planck scale. For two extra dimensions, it's somewhere between 25 and 30 TeV. For three extra dimensions, it's of the order of a few TeV. For any higher number of extra dimensions, limits are not really interesting. They're much below 1 TeV. The other observations which people made was the distortion of cosmic diffusion gamma radiation, which was measured by Comptel telescope some 10 years ago. And this distortion would happen because the massive Kaluza-Klein gravitons can now decay in, say, a pair of photons, and therefore the spectrum of diffuse radiation would have some characteristic imprints on it, which are different from the cosmological spectrum of this radiation. And these people were able to convert the non-observation of any visible distortion as measured by Comptel into limits which are similar, in order of 100 TeV for two extra dimensions, few TeV for three extra dimensions, and no visible limits, interesting limits for any higher number of extra dimensions. Similar limits come from the effect of the overclosure of the universe and matter dominance in the early universe as opposed to photon dominance if gravitons start decaying too fast.
And more recent observation was the lack of the gamma emission from the neutron star, which allowed Henestad and Raffel to set quite strict limits on the Planck scale for n equals 2 and 3. The idea behind this paper is that during the collapse of the star, which becomes a neutron star, if gravitational interaction is strong enough, a lot of gravitons will be trapped in the gravitational field of the neutron star, and then these gravitons would start slowly decaying in a pair of photons, and therefore you would be able to see these photons as the emission from the neutron star. Now, all the neutron star candidates we know of are really dark. They don't emit any observable photon radiation, and therefore they converted this non-observation of gamma emission in the limits on the number of gravitons which would be trapped in the neutron star. Of course, there's a lot of caveats about all these calculations, because there are many known and perhaps even more unknown uncertainties which enter these cosmological bounds. After all, we don't even know if we have true neutron stars observed. We have many candidates, but just like the black holes, we don't really have crucial evidence that a particular object which is compact and dense is a neutron star and not subcritical. And similar arguments could be applied to the, say, supernova cooling, because we might be underestimating the alternative mechanisms of the supernova, overestimating the alternative mechanism of the cooling. Nevertheless, so I would say that these limits really should be taken with a grain of salt and probably are good as an order of magnitude estimates. Nevertheless, 1,000 TeV sounds like a big number, so even if they're all by a factor of 100, it's still a large number. So I would say that the host of these different observations clearly disfavored the case of two extra dimensions. However, any number of extra dimensions greater than two is still perfectly allowed by both the measurements of gravity at the short distances and astrophysical constraints. So that brings me to the colliders, which are ultimate base of probing various extra dimensions, large or small. And the way we probe this phenomena at the colliders is actually very simple. The Kaluza-Klein gravitons still couple to the energy momentum tensor, which means that you could add a graviton as an additional leg to any Feynman diagram which you can draw for particle collisions. For example, when you scatter quark and anti-quark, a gluon often comes out. And if you add the graviton to this diagram, you would have a production of a single jet, gluon jet, and something which escapes your detector. So this is what's called monojet signature. It's quite spectacular because you see apparent momentum non-conservation in your detector. A high energy jet goes in one direction, nothing else really energetic comes out of this collision. This would be quite a spectacular signature to look for. However, there are certain caveats which I will tell you about in a minute about these type of observations. So the Feynman rules for these Feynman diagrams with gravitons have been derived for 8 years now. And there are other type of processes which we could look at, which is, well, first of all, in E plus E minus collisions, we could look for gravitons which are emitted along with the vector boson or the photon. But also both E plus E minus colliders and hadron colliders, we could look for effects of virtual gravitons, which are similar to the Drellian, except that you replace Z here with the graviton. And you would have fermion-fermion bars scattered in fermion-fermion bar with additional contribution from this diagram, which becomes larger and larger as you go higher in energy. So you would see distortion of, say, E plus E minus spectrum in either E plus E minus or PP machine. Of course, since graviton also can couple to photons or vector bosons, you could look for similar effects in production of pair of bosons, not only pair of fermions. And it turns out that these two type of processes are actually complementary to one the other, because these processes can be cleanly calculated via these Feynman rules, and there's really no uncertainty about the production cross-section for the monojets. However, when you calculate the virtual diagrams, it turns out that the answer is divergent, and it really depends on the place where you cut off this Kaluza-Klein excitation tau. It's natural to expect that it would be cut off at about Planck scale. However, it could be cut off a little bit below or a little bit above the Planck scale, depending on particular ultraviolet physics. If it's a stringy type of models, then it would be probably a string scale, which is lower than the Planck scale. In some other models, it could be something else. So although these two type of processes measure similar things, one really is sensitive to true fundamental Planck scale, MG, whereas the other one is sensitive to the ultraviolet cutoff of the Kaluza-Klein tau. So in this sense, they're completely complementary. So LAP really did a lot in cleaning up this mess. And this is the Leckie log, what happened after LAP was turned off. And effectively, you see that they look both in direct graviton emission, the monophotons and mono-Zs, and also pair production, modification of pair production of various fermions and bosons. And different limits are shown from different experiments here. The bottom line is actually shown here that the combined limit from LAP from all the virtual graviton exchange set the limit on the ultraviolet cutoff between 1.1 and 1.2 TeV, depending on the sign of the interference of this diagram, whether it's positive or negative. For direct graviton emission, and by the way, this number depends on the number of extra dimensions only weakly. On the other hand, direct graviton emission, the limits on the Planck scale depend quite significantly on the number of extra dimensions. Sensitivity drops as the number of extra dimensions increases, and they range somewhere between 1 TeV and 0.5 TeV. So that's close to the range we want to probe, but certainly no cigar. We couldn't really exclude anything above 1.5 TeV by either of these measurements. So let me now go to the monojets, which would be really a very nice signature at Hadron Collider because cross-section is large. The problem with monojets is that it's really a very tough signature experimentally and also has somewhat tainted history in particle physics. For those of you who don't recognize this gentleman, that's Carlo Rubier, who in 1984 presented these results for UA1 calibration, published paper on experimental observation of events with large missing transverse energy accompanied by a jet or a photon, that's a monojet or monophoton. And I highlight the abstract observation of five events cannot be explained from the standard model. And of course, there were tons of theoretical papers from different people which call this a discovery of a monojet and have different interpretation of this. I think John was also interested in some of this models. Nevertheless, it turns out that this event excess was really due to the unaccounted background, and this whole signature was deemed doomed and nearly forgotten for many years, and it really took about 10 years for the first successful monojet analysis at the Hadron Collider to be completed at the Tevatron. And life is just much harder than one would expect. The reason the life is much harder, this missing energy is really a very tough signature because jets are not really nice objects like electrons or photons. They tend to fluctuate wildly in the detector. And also, the missing energy or jets could appear from dead calorimeter cells or hot cells in the calorimeter where you don't detect the energy, or some cracks in the detector where a particle could just escape through. And just to illustrate this, just to show you how the raw missing energy spectrum looks in CDF experiment and D0 experiment before any quality cuts I applied, you see that the rate is enormous. And in case of D0, you could actually fake things like peaks or shouters or anything you want. And it takes about 5 years to clear this mess and go from this white histogram here, or the red histogram here, into the nice yellow histogram, which is after all the cuts are done, or this sort of brownish histogram in case of D0, which really shows you the physics contributing to missing ET. So while it is clearly a very interesting signature, it's a tough experimental challenge, and it's not very likely that very early LHC data would help us to uncover this monojet channel because it would take us some time to understand the detector and the instrumental effects. So the best search for monojets so far belongs to the CDF collaboration at the Fermilab Pevatron, and this is their preliminary result, which set the limit on the fundamental Planck scale between 1.3 and 1.9 GeV, TeV, depending on the number of extra dimensions. These limits are complementary to the combined lab limits. Pevatron offer high sensitivity for large number of extra dimensions, where lab simply runs out of energy. For the LHC, the simulations only exist with sort of fast detector, toy detector model, which doesn't take into account instrumental effects. So you could consider these to be optimistic expectations, but with 30 or 100 inverse femtobarn, one might expect to actually probe the fundamental Planck scale between 5 and 8 or 6 and 9 TeV, which probably would be significantly high to actually start seeing these effects or start curbing this model significantly. Going to the virtual graviton effects, the best limits come from the D0 experiment with just 200 inverse picobarn of dating round 2. These limits range between 1.1 and 1.7 TeV, the tightest to date, again between 1 and 2 TeV. With the LHC, with 100 inverse femtobarn, one might expect that this sensitivity would raise to 8, 13 TeV, again, enough to start seeing the effects if the large extra dimensions are there to address the hierarchy problem. These events, by the way, are very clean, so those could be early measurement at the LHC. This is one of the first high-mass dielectron events in D0, and they're so clean that you can actually give them names of opera singers or whatever you want. So there's a couple of events, diphoton event and dielectron event, seen in D0. Unfortunately, the Pevatron cannot really improve much on the current limits because it's really driven not by the luminosity, but by the energy of the machine. Virtual graviton effects at the LHC could be, as I said, quite a quick discovery mode. And even with a few inverse femtobarn, one could start seeing effects of the order of 5 and 6 TeV. So that might be 2008 discovery if we are so lucky to have something like large extra dimensions with Planck scale below 5 TeV. For inverse TeV extra dimensions, as I said, you would expect to have the subsequent excitation of Kaluza-Klein power of, say, Z resonance or W boson or a photon. They're all degenerate, so Z and photon are degenerate. You would look for the resonance in, say, dielectron or dimuon invariant mass spectrum. And there are current indirect constraints, however, which come from precision electric measurements, which limit the size of these extra dimensions to something like 1 over R less than 6 TeV. So if that means that the spacing between subsequent modes would be of the order of 6 TeV, which is very close to the reach of the LHC machine. So even if these extra dimensions are there, LHC might have a hard time even seeing the first excitation of the Z, because 6 TeV pretty much close to the sensitivity of the collider. In this case, the IOC could actually offer a better sensitivity because from indirect effects, they could go to something like 15 TeV. However, these indirect effects, they clearly depend on the details of loop calculations, so it's still worth looking for these effects. And the people at Lab, Hera, and Pevatron all did this. This comes from the Pevatron analysis, where the direct search for the second excitation was made, and the limit on the inverse radius of 0.8 TeV has been set. And the LHC would have a field day with looking for excitations for the Z boson. These are a couple of plots from Atlas and CMS, which show that they could see non-vanishing signal all the way to the 6 or 7 TeV with sufficient amount of statistics. So there is a good reach in these models which LHC would offer. And even with one inverse femtobar, one could exclude masses less than about 5 or 6 TeV, which again could be as early as 2008 or 2009 discovery or limit. So now let's go to the last class of model, the Randall-Sundrum model. And let us talk about different observables. Instead of talking about the warp factor K and compactification radius R, it's more convenient to talk about things we can measure directly. And this thing could be the mass of the first excitation, and then the dimensionless coupling, which is K divided by reduced Planck mass, K over M Planck. It turns out that theoretically, K couldn't be too large or too small. The preferred values of K over M Planck is between 0.1 and 0.01. If it's too small, you start getting into trouble with oblique parameters. If it's too large, then you basically lose the perturbativity and you cannot calculate anything in these models. And the current allowed region, if you want this lambda pi, the induced scale on the standard model brain, to be less than 10 TeV, is shown here. So this 2 basically shows you where the most interesting model parameters would lie. And that corresponds to the mass of the first excitation of the graviton, somewhere between a few hundred GeV and, say, 3 or 4 TeV. That is perfectly fine in terms of the reach of the LHC. And in fact, even Tevatron can tell something about these models. The first search for Randall Sundrum graviton was done in D0 in 2005. And that's the first published limit. You see that graviton masses below, say, 500 and 800 GeV were excluded depending on the value of this coupling. Coupling basically dictates the strength of the graviton coupling to standard model field. The higher coupling is, the more cross-section you have, therefore your limits become more strict. And the latest limit count is 4 times statistics of the order of 1 inverse femtobarn from both CDF and D0 experiment. Unfortunately, they don't really enhance the previous exclusion much. So 800 GeV became 850 GeV or 900 GeV. And that tells you that, again, the Tevatron is running out of steam because this is a high-energy effect. You cannot really beat it with the luminosity because all you could do with the luminosity is just probe the very tail of parking distribution function, which is exponentially dropping. So it's very hard to increase energy by running longer. You really want to go to the next machine. And the LHC would clearly have a field day with these type of models. Even with a handful of inverse femtobarn, the gravitons with the mass less than 3 or 4 TeV could be either found or excluded. And you see that with about 10 inverse femtobarn, most of this allowed picture would be excluded in a single channel, in this case, electron channel, by a single experiment. And this few inverse femtobarn, similar, can be done in muon channel, again, in a single experiment. So this, again, would be early discovery or early exclusion from the LHC. LHC has a good chance of excluding or finding Randall Sundrum model if they have anything to do with electrically excitable braking mechanism. So let me skip a couple slides on the details. One could look for this phenomenon in diejet channel and die-tau channel. However, these are much more complicated experimentally. Diejet channels are significantly affected by the unknown parking distribution function at large axis, which we have to measure first at the LHC. So it's a little bit tough measurement. Die-taus are also rather tough, but actually Tevatron was able to make the first precision measurements with tau channel very early in run 2, so we might be able to look at die-taus with early LHC data, which we have also interest for other models not related to extra dimensions. Finally, if we see some effect, can we tell that this was a graviton? Can we measure the spin of the graviton by looking at angular distribution of decay products of these resonances? Well, this is a tough job, and while we like to say that one event is the discovery, two events is the cross-section measurement, and three events is the differential cross-section measurement, the reality is a little bit more complicated because you really need of the order of 100 inverse femtobarn in order to distinguish the spin 2 hypothesis from spin 1 and spin 0 hypothesis. However, certain things could be done rather early. For example, if you see the resonance in both diphoton channel and dielectron or dimuon channel at the same mass, you know that it couldn't be a spin 1 particle because spin 1 particle doesn't decay in a pair of photons according to Landau-Young theorem. So at least you could exclude spin 1, which is the most prominent case for, say, Z primes and other models with extra UA1 groups, and say that it's either spin 2 or spin 0, which already would be quite interesting because you exclude large class of models. But life may be much more complicated, and this is one example where you start peeling particles from the standard model brain and allow, say, fermions to propagate in the bulk space between Planck brain and standard model brain. The reason to do this is to actually build realistic models of flavor or prohibit the flavor-changing neutral currents in the Randall-Sundrum type of models. In this case, it turns out that the right-handed top quark has to be localized near the standard model brain because of the overlap with the Higgs wave function. That's the only way of making top heavy. Whereas all the light fermions would naturally be localized close to the Planck brain. Since the graviton in these type of models is localized close to the standard model brain, it really only overlaps with the top. It doesn't overlap much with light fermions at all, which means that the graviton won't really decay in pair of electrons. It would mainly decay, if it's massive enough, in a pair of right-handed top quarks. Now, looking for top quark pair production sounds like an easy proposition for the LHC, because LHC is known to be top factory. It produces a lot of TT-bar pairs. However, these are very special top pairs, because they come from the decay of a resonance of, say, mass of 4 TeV. So these top quarks are enormously boosted. Each of them has the gamma factor between 10 and 20. And that means that when the top quark decays, say, in a W and a B jet, and W in its turn decays in another pair of jets, all these three jets are boosted forward, so they all become very collimated. And experimentally, you cannot really distinguish between these three jets. You see them as a single jet. So this TT bar event decaying instead of six jets would decay in a pair of jets. And that's very hard experimentally to distinguish from the QCD background. There is a lot of interest by both phenomenologists and experimentalists how to try to sort of disentangle these fat merged jets from the jets coming from the QCD, and some ideas are being looked at by the Mizouche 2007 workshop. Particularly, one could apply something like KT algorithm with the rather small D parameter to look for substructure of the jet within the jet. But that's going to be quite a tough measure. And of course, there are more challenges. Let me skip the universal extra dimensions. Basically, universal extra dimensions might offer you the case which looks pretty much like a supersymmetry. And universal extra dimensions is just T inverse TV model where all the particles are allowed to propagate in the bulk. And there is a certain conservation law which allows to avoid experimental constraints, just like R parity allows to avoid many experimental constraints in supersymmetry. But let me just address that before one can really succeed in searches, there's a lot of things experimentalists have to do, and mainly proper calibrate the line and simulate the detector, which is a daunting task, which easily takes several years, as, for example, in the case of the MonoJet. So while a few spectacular discoveries may happen as early as 2008, most would require 2 or 3 years of accelerated running and operating, as well as the detectors. So we all should gear up for a longer ride than just 1 year, although we all would like to see the discovery coming early on. So there are several challenges which I'll skip. That's a little bit too experimental. And now let's talk about the subtle signature, which is the black holes at the LHC. So the idea is actually quite simple. If gravity is fundamentally strong force, when the two particles approach each other to the distance comparable with the size of extra dimensions, they will start feeling the entire tower of Kaluza-Klein excitations of the graviton, which might be just enough for them to collapse in a Schwarzschild curve singularity, and then this black hole would evaporate by Hawking radiation. So this cross-section could actually be calculated using a very simple geometrical approach, which tells you that if you have two partons, the invariant mass of these partons squared is just equal to the root S hat, that's the energy, overall center of mass energy of this collision. And you could calculate the Schwarzschild radius corresponding to this mass m. And if the two photons approach each other to the distance less than the Schwarzschild radius, you would expect them to collapse in a black hole, which allows you to calculate the cross-sectional black hole production, which is just pi rs squared, or of the order of inverse TeV in more common units that's equal to 100 picobar, which is comparable with the top quark production cross-section at the LHC. In fact, LHC at full luminosity would produce one black hole a second if the cross-section is so large. There have been a lot of discussion about how valid the geometrical cross-section approximation is, and by the end of the day, pretty much all the parties agreed that it's not really a very naive, at least, approximation. It's likely that this is going to hold to a certain extent. At least that's what the calculations in pure general relativity show you. So for massive enough black holes, we're quite sure that the geometrical limit is reasonable. And I'm sure Steve Giddings will talk more about this tomorrow. Of course, there's a lot of assumption and approximation which go in this simple picture, particularly the main limitation is complete lack of knowledge of quantum gravity effect close to the Planck scale, which certainly would affect the black holes which have a mass close to the Planck mass. So what we did in our original paper is basically ignored all the partial improvements which you could make by taking into account spin, charge, color of black hole, gray body factors, relativistic effects, and time dependence. Because those are first to be out of the window once you start building realistic models in some realistic theory of quantum gravity. So what we try to do is just focus and zoom on two very generic features of the black hole. First of all, the absence of small coupling. Gravity is coupled to the strength of the order of one. And the democracy of gravity, meaning that gravity couples to the energy momentum tensor, so it doesn't distinguish between different degrees of freedom of the standard model. And what we try to do is just come up with the most robust predictions, which are not a precision type of measurement, but just very generic features of the black holes produced at the LHC. And you could calculate the cross-section quite honestly, and it indeed becomes similar to this easy approximation which I told you about. It's somewhere between 100 femtobar and hundreds of picobars for the Planck mass between 2 and 6 TeV. Also, what you could calculate is the branching fraction of appearance of various particles in the process of the black hole evaporation. Even before our paper, people knew that the black hole, which would be produced in models with large extra dimensions, would mainly evaporate on the brain. This is Emperor and Horowitz and Myers' observation, which has to do with the fact that black hole is just too small, so it only radiates S waves. It's like a point radiator. And S waves don't really take, couldn't take advantage of additional degrees of freedom in the bulk, because they're spherical waves. So black hole couples to a particle in the bulk with the same strength that couples to a particle on the brain. And since there's only one particle in the bulk, which is a graviton, and there are hundreds of particles on the brain, which are all the standard model degrees of freedom, the probability of decaying into the in the brain degree of freedom is just much higher than the bulk degree of freedom. And then if you calculate all the couplings to 120 standard model degrees of freedom, which take into account spin, color, and so forth, basically 75% of the particles you would emit in the evaporation are gluons and quarks because of the large color factors. And then 5% of these particles would be photons, 10% of the particles would be charged leptons. So the ratio of leptons and photons to quarks and gluons in this evaporation is dramatically different from any known standard model process. It's not 1 in 1,000, which is typical to the QCD-like processes, where it's just the ratio of strong coupling to electromagnetic coupling spirit, but it's of the order of 1 to 10 or 1 to 5. So it's really significantly enhanced production of electroweak particles in this QCD soup which comes out of the black hole. So one could actually do some fun measurements, such as try to measure the number of extra dimensions in space by correlating Hawking temperature with the mass of the black hole. And I don't really claim that this is a precision calculation, because this certainly will be modified by quantum gravity, but if the black hole, if the Planck scale is light enough, massive enough black hole might allow you to trace this and actually tell what dimensionality of extra space there is, which would be quite interesting. Also, it turns out that in Randall-Sundrum models, these similar things would happen. They would happen because in Randall-Sundrum model, essentially, black hole is so small that you could ignore the size of this, Schwarzschild radius compared to the size of the extra dimension, because the black hole in the direction of anti-de Sitter warp extra dimension would be squashed by the same exponential factor. So it would become extremely small. It's really a pancake rather than a round object. And therefore, this black hole would technically look like a black hole in large extra dimensions when the number of extra dimensions is equal to 1. So we know that this case has been excluded completely by existence of the solar system. Nevertheless, if you see the black hole, which would have, let me skip all this formal, which would have this relationship between the mass and the temperature, which is characteristic of n equals 1 extra dimension, you could be quite sure that this is not the black hole in the ADD model, but you are dealing with the Randall-Sundrum models. And I won't really have much time going about that, but there is a recent paper by Lisa Randall and Patrick Mead, who have somewhat different conclusions because they use a little bit different approximation. The bottom line is that this is theoretically possible. Nevertheless, the Randall-Sundrum models, already being rather curbed by a host of electric precision measurement and direct observation, so we may not be able to actually produce a lot of black holes because the parameter space available for this to happen is getting smaller and smaller with time. Finally, as a fun thing, one could actually look for new physics in the black hole decays as the alternative mechanism of discovering new particles, because we don't know that some particle exists, but certainly gravity does, and if it does exist, this particle would be essentially produced in the process of black hole evaporation with the branching fraction equal to the number of degrees of freedom for this particle divided by the total number of degrees of freedom for the standard model. Just for fun, I looked at the production of Higgs particle in the black hole decay, and it turns out that with even small statistics, one could see the Higgs decay in a pair of big quark jets as a peak among the invariant mass of various jets, as sort of one way of discovering light Higgs in this type of models, and that can be actually competitive with standard searches for the Higgs. Okay, just to tell you that actually many people have started to look into these type of models for the LHC. I put a couple event displays made by a couple of the generators on the market. Mark will tell you about third generation generator, Catfish, which I don't have a picture of, but I'm sure he will show you a lot of nice picture about this. But the bottom line is these events are spectacular. They have a lot of energy emitted in large number of particles, 5 or 6. Some of them are jets, but many of them are electrons and photons. So it's really very hard to miss, and that would be day one, so to speak, discovery of the LHC, if you are so lucky. So that brings me to the conclusions. I think that the possibility of extra dimensional space, while it's a bold theoretical idea, certainly it received quite a facelift over the last 10 years. And now there are serious attempts to solve the hierarchy problem and other problems of the standard model via this alternative framework. There's enormous amount of interest in the past 9 or 10 years, both on theoretical, phenomenological, and on experimental sides to these models. And they all really give you very different but quite spectacular signatures, large cross sections, and they are extremely attractive for full exploration at the LHC. Some of these signatures may nevertheless be quite challenging, like this graviton decaying in the right-handed top quarks, but in most of the scenarios, you really have a lot of nice, clean, and exciting signatures, which will be probably the first signatures for quantum gravity, if we're lucky to have any of these models or some combination of these models, be realized in nature. So if the scale of gravity is of the order of a TeV, copious production of black holes at LHC would likely to be an early and definitively more spectacular signature for extra, definitely most spectacular signature for extra dimensions. And this possibility would really fulfill our dreams of grand unification. This won't be grand unification of gauge forces. This will be grand unification of a different ultimate kind, the unification of particle physics, astrophysics, and cosmology. And that's really the great grand unification to live for. Thank you very much.
Can you say a little bit more about the differences between the mean standard assumptions and yours? It's amazing to get very different conclusions, right? If I understood correctly, they're saying that looking for black holes wasn't a promising thing to do, because you're already looking for deviations in diegetic cross-section.
You're talking now not about the Randall standard model, but generic vision of the black hole. What we said can be if they took into account a lot of things. First of all, they took into account jet reaction, then they took into account only gray body factors. And they also used a different sort of assumption where the onset of black hole production turns on. You know, the factors of 2 pi, square root of 2 pi, which you can put in different definition of Planck scale. Depending on which side you put these 2 pi's, you could get higher cross-section or lower cross-section. Their conclusion that the black hole would decay mainly in two jets basically has to do with the entropy calculations they did. They say that black hole doesn't have time to thermalize, so essentially what's coming in would come out. It's not really formed in a classical sense. It doesn't have time to form. And this crucially depends on how you calculate the entropy and what you take as the gray body factors and what you take as the onset, how the black hole turns on around the Planck scale. So they certainly could be right, but essentially that would mean that the definition of Planck scale becomes heavier than the Planck scale I'm talking about. But personally, I believe that really you have to put a lot of trust in all these GR-based classical calculations when you apply them at the onset of the quantum production of black holes. So all these calculations could be modified by significant factors. In this sense, I think that we should really wait a couple of years and see if we start seeing anything resembling the black holes, and then we could figure out what is the right factors to put in order to compare the observed cross-section with geometrical cross-section. At this point, I really think it's a wishful thinking. If you try to treat it as precision science, it's not. It's fundamentally not precision science.
Yeah, I was about to ask a question about exactly this point. So in the lack of knowledge about the end state of black hole evaporation, it's usually assumed that at the fundamental scale, the black hole just makes a final decay to some few particles. Now, unfortunately, the LHC is a hadron collider, so most of these black holes actually would be produced by close by the scale and not be some larger mass nice things that would have some Hawking evaporation. So if one takes this into account, how good is actually the sensitivity to, you know, the number of dimensions?
Right, now that's again an open question. I showed it not as a precision type of measurement. This is really a sort of more of a visual thinking, what you could do if you're able to model this thing. One thing which is clear to me that if we are lucky to produce large sample of black holes, we would be able to figure out these effects we can only approximate now just by measuring them. Because one advantage of the LHC is that being a hadron machine, it actually produces black holes with non-zero charges and quantum numbers. Most of the black holes, for example, would have color. Most of the black holes would have fractional electric charge because they're producing QQ collisions predominantly. That's the main source of particle luminosity at these high masses. So by looking at the decay products of these black holes, we could probably classify their initial quantum numbers and see the difference. So that might help us to figure out how the these quantum numbers are gauged, for example, where a variant quantum number is gauged or not, or lepton quantum number gauged or not, because we could see lepton violation, for example, in the decay of these black holes, or we may see perfect conservation of variant and lepton number. Unfortunately, existing generators don't even allow you to simulate things which break the baryon number conservation. They're just the whole machinery breaks down. So This hasn't been studied in the details yet, but again, I think studying this thing as the precision size is a little bit premature. That's certainly a very speculative idea, and I would just say that if you see something resembling the black holes or spin balls, we would have plenty of time on our hands to figure it out. And the next thing you would do, you would just build a click machine at 5 TeV or 3 TeV, whatever you need, and you produce these black holes at rest, this quantum number equal to the quantum numbers of vacuum, and you would figure out all you need. And I bet you that if we produce black holes at the LHC, there won't be problems in finding click.
Wouldn't these black holes produced in the atmosphere as well?
Yes, Mark will talk about this in detail, so I didn't want to steal his thing. And, the only problem is that it's just harder to detect them, but Pierre Auger Observatory, for example, has certain sensitivity. In fact, it could be competitive with the LHC if the Planck scale is very low. Yeah.
Their numbers, of course, produced depends on their sizes. And
right, so their numbers depends, the number of black holes observed would depend critically on the size of the Planck scale. If the Planck scale is less than about 2 TeV, they might be competitive. But 2 TeV is close to current experimental limits, so it's a very small fringe which remains. But Mark will tell you more about that. Yes?
You're a bit pessimistic about looking for model jets missing energy events in general. Of course, many of these phenomena are supersymmetry extra dimension black holes. You can pick up using lepton signatures, for example.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it wouldn't necessarily be dependent on the missing energy signature.
No, not at all. So black holes would pick up by looking at energetic photons and electrons or muons in high temperature QCD-like events. So that doesn't depend on missing energy. In fact, the amount of missing energy is quite small because neutrinos and red quarks only contribute about 5% of the branching fraction of the decay of the black holes. For the case of the monojets, jets, well, you would have to deal with monojets, jets, but as you say, you could also look at virtual graviton effects at the same time and just see these effects from the host of different observations. And don't get me wrong, I'm not pessimistic about monojets. I was doing the monojet analysis for D0, and I know it can be done. It just would take a little longer. That's all I'm saying, that it's not the first year measurement.
Any other questions? You know,